You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you in association with Van Riesel, the bike company born in Lille in the heart of French Flanders. And we're very happy to say that Van Riesel is sponsoring the Cycling Podcast coverage of the first half of the Tour de France, including the Grand Départ in Lille this weekend, which is a city where Van Riesel was founded in 2019. We'll be hearing a lot more about the company as the tour goes on, the innovation that goes into their bike design, and the Decathlon Ager Desert La Mondiale team, whose bikes and kit they supply.
And really, the tour, I think, tells you something about life, because if you follow your front wheel, you kind of end up exactly where you're supposed to be.
Now, I'm wearing my Cassiolet podcast t-shirt, because normally down in the southwest, I would seek out a Cassiolet if we were staying in Carcassonne.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now.
Welcome to part two of the Cycling Podcast's big Tour de France preview with me, Graham Wilgos. We're in the company of Rob Hatch, but first, here's Lionel Burney.
Shall we hear from François Thomazeau again about the middle week, which is heavily dominated by the Pyrenees, but for me, it's Cassoulet week, because it goes from one great city of Cassoulet, Toulouse, to the other, Carcassonne. I know Foix will throw its hat into the ring a bit there as well, and stake a claim to being the true spiritual home of, well, what is it? Bean, goose, duck, sausage stew. The perfect meal for the end of a day when temperatures have been nudging 40 degrees. Looking forward to it immensely. But this is what the Pyrenees has in store for the tour this year. Well, François, the middle week of the Tour de France really is the Pyrenees, isn't it? In and around the Pyrenees for the whole week, starting off with a stage that starts and finishes in Toulouse, a city that I really love, and I think you do too. It's a great city, Toulouse, I think, and probably be one for the sprinters, but it's a little bit bumpy. Then we have the massive finish at Hautacam. The approach isn't as hard as it could have been, and isn't as hard as it has been in the past for stage 12. They're going over the Col de Soulor and the Col de Bordère. Then there's the time trial at Perigueux, where you stole my black pudding many years ago at the press buffet, François. I looked round, there was only one piece of black pudding left, and it was on my plate, and you pinched it. It's also where the opening scene...
No regrets.
It's also where the opening scene of a James Bond film that I haven't watched was filmed, Tomorrow Never Dies. And they always have the yellow Citroen 2CV there, don't they, to kind of draw in the James Bond fans. This is the road that was the same finish of the stage 3 years ago when Pogacar and Vingegaard went head-to-head in the sprint. They'll be going head-to-head, but in the time trial. And then stage 14 really excites me, because the Super Bannière feels like one of those Tour de France classics. It's where Greg LeMond won that incredible stage in the battle with Bernardino in 1986. And then we finish the week with, well, it's Cassoulet week, really, isn't it? Because we can have Cassoulet in Toulouse and then Cassoulet in Carcassonne and compare the two. But this is classic Pyrenean territory for the Tour.
Yeah, apart from Super Bannière, they didn't get back to Super Bannière till 1989, because there's a bridge over a river there, going into the last climb to Super Bannière, and it was not good enough for the Tour to go past that bridge, and they actually rebuilt the bridge last year, making it possible to get back to Super Bannière. I've been interviewed like a dozen times this year about the 1986 Super Bannière stage, because it was my first Tour de France. I'm one of the old guys who were lucky enough to witness that big fight between Greg LeMond and Bernardino. I'll send you all of you back to Slain the Badger, Richard Moore's book about 1986 Tour de France, because that's everything's there, and it's a way of to remember Richard, of course. But more than that, it's a great book, a great story, and most of the story unfolded in that climb to Super Albania. Quickly, we'll go back a million times on that story. But you know, there was a deal between Hinault and Le Mans that Hinault would help Greg win the Tour de France, and Hinault seemed up to that point to do exactly the opposite. He attacked Le Mans, led by 4 minutes, and then he cracked on Super Albania, and Greg Le Mans took back almost all the time he'd lost in the. So, you know. Once again, back to the tour history, back to the great moments of the tour, and this, you know, really intention by Prudhomme to take the tour back to the scene of the crime, if you wish. So, Peyragudes is also a place where Romain Bardet shone back in the day, and I'll just quickly, because we were in his home territory at Puy de Sancy as well. Romain Bardet retired. As we speak, by you know, doing the Dauphiné was his last race, apparently. So, but apart from that, as you say, typical Pyrenees stage. We'll be going through Saint-Savin. The race is going through Saint-Savin after the Col de Bordère as we go to Otacam. Saint-Savin, which is, as you know, the place where we always stop. Well, yes, almost always stop to. Dine at Le Viscos, which is a place that many of you know by now, and I can tell you that I will be at Le Viscos on the race day. So that, I don't know if Lionel, I know you'll be around, so I might be on the pod again that day. I think it's on July the 17th.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Lionel, I was delighted to hear you mention with Francois there, Tomorrow Never Dies, even if you have never seen it, the Bond film, Pierce Brosnan's second Bond film. We won't be getting Bond wrong on this podcast, but there's a moment in the opening to that film where the missile is out of range that's launched from an aircraft carrier, with Peyragudes being a sort of Russian terrorist bazaar outpost. That's more than enough of that. What I'm getting to here is who is going to be the missile out of range on that time trial, or is it too short for any of the GC men or anyone else for that matter to put any serious time in? Because it's the return of the mountain time trial, first of all, to the tour, but it is only 10.9K. So it is a pure mountain, it's a pure vertical mission.
It's going to be the one day where we see Pogacar and Vingegaard go head to head without their teams. And I think the relative strength of their teams is going to be one of the themes of the race, isn't it, Rob? I mean, João Almeida has been in great form. UAE Team Emirates across the board have really dominated the season. And yet, Visma Lisa Bike have got plenty in there. Armory as well. I mean, Simon Yates has just won the Giro d'Italia and he's going to be riding as a real mountain domestique deluxe for Vingegaard. They've got Matteo Jorgensen, of course, and Wout van Aert. I mean, if he rides for Vingegaard the way he rode for Simon Yates in the Giro, I mean, that's like having a teammate and a half in itself on the right day. So I think the opportunities to see the two riders go really head to head, we'll obviously see it on the road in the regular mountain stages, but that time trial, if it's close, and I know we're talking about the middle of the race, an awful lot can happen before then, but it's one of those days that will has the potential, even though it's only short, to open up surprising time gaps, perhaps.
Anyone who stood at the top of that runway up there realises, and just look down, it's almost like looking off the edge of a cliff, but you're expecting a plane to land up there. It's a very, very strange place. It does take your breath away, actually, because you've got the beautiful natural scenery in the background. You've got this weird runway slapped on the mountainside as well up there. You've got a bit of a, it's a really small ski resort behind as well. It's a strange, strange place. But when you see what they have to take on, the surface, the gradient, that is going to be a painful, painful day against the clock. I mean, time trialing is about hurting yourself as much as you can anyway, isn't it? But on that parkour, deary me. And Lionel, you touched on the strength of the teams there. Visma Lisebike, they've got 3 Grand Tour winners just in the team. I mean, you've got Vingegaard, you've got Yates, you've got Kuss, multiple Grand Tour winners on two of the occasions as well in Yates and Vingegaard. You also touched on João Almeida. This man, for 4 years, couldn't buy a stage race overall win. He won two in 2021.
You're not allowed to buy them.
You're not allowed to do that.
Not allowed.
It's a fundamental misunderstanding of the core concept.
I need to start again, don't I? Dearie me. But yeah, he won the Tour of Poland and the Tour of Luxembourg in 2021, and he got mightily close on a few occasions, even at the start of the year in Valencia, when you sort of thought, ah, here we go again. He's thrown it away. What's going on here? Second in Valencia, second in the Algarve. Yes, he was working with his mate at Paris-Nice, but since then, played 3-1-3, all World Tour, all very prestigious races. Basque Country, Romandie, Swiss. Stage wins at two of those, of course, as well. Absolutely brilliant. 26 years of age now, in the prime of his cycling career. He's going to do Tour and Vuelta this year, we think, as well. So he should be there for Pogacar tilt at the Vuelta. And he could be a key man when it comes to that final week. And we hinted at a possible Visma strategy earlier on, didn't we? And, you know, waiting for that sort of Grand Tour terrain and hoping that fatigue and early excitement for the man who just can't help himself kicks in. But if he's got Almeida there, and then you add in the usual list as well, you know, the likes of Adam Yates, who didn't have a great Giro, but was still up there. And, you know, he turns up to the big appointments as well. He knows his job. He knows his role. You're looking at a mega, mega team, but facing off against another mega, mega team. I think I would maybe say that Visma could just edge the team, depending on which bit you're looking at. I think in the first week, there's probably a bit more support for Pogacar there as well. You've got Wellens, Narvaez, Pollitt. But I mean, it's so difficult. I mean, I could get out of bed on one side and say that team's stronger. I could get out of the bed on the other side the next morning and say, oh, no, hang on a minute, the other team's stronger. It's really difficult to pick. And I think that, you know, the block versus block. I mean, the proxy war of domestiques, the brothers, the twins, that could be an interesting thing in itself.
Yates versus Yates, the battle of Berry, the battle for black pudding. I think the thing with João Almeida is, what point does his personal ambition take over? I mean, last year he was able to finish fourth in the Tour because Pogacar was so dominant and really had the race wrapped up, and he could just ride around as part of that group. They didn't really have to fend off too much threat. Almeida will clearly want to finish on the podium, won't he? He'll want to be very, very close. Whereas the sort of the smart team strategy would be to make sure that he is able to ride hard in the final week if needed, or the final 2 weeks really if needed. And you know, you could, it's very, very difficult to ask a rider to not take too many risks in the first week and sacrifice a GC position, especially when it's a rider, Almeida, the season he's had, the fact he was fourth last year, the fact that he will clearly want to get, well, if he could, I'm sure he'd want to be second to Pogacar. And then if anything happened to his team leader, he would be there to inherit the yellow jersey. So it's a real tricky managerial balance act. Where I do get the feeling with Visma Lisebike, the pecking order has been so well honed over a long period of time. You know, every rider sort of knows their place a lot more clearly. There isn't a real young buck with bags of ambition and bags of kind of potential to win the race themselves, perhaps.
I think maybe they have that in Matteo Jorgensen. However, it does seem, at least to the outside, that he knows his role, he's accepted his role, and he's more than happy to give it for the cause. For UAE, we've had recent evidence, very recent, as in the Giro d'Italia, that, you know, you get certain characters involved, it makes it pretty, pretty difficult.
I think that's the key point there, is the character, whereas Jorgensen feels like he is quite happy to be a lieutenant. He's very good at playing that role, whereas You know, like you say, with the Giro and Del Toro, that's not necessarily the case. On João Almeida, we saw how dominant he was at the Tour de Suisse. One British man who pushed him close on at least a couple of stages was Oscar Onley. We spoke to him for last week's cycling podcast. Onley for Picnic Post NL, he's having debuted at the Tour last year. He's looking at stage hunting and all going well, we'll be looking for a top 10 overall on GC. I think what we would like to see in that second week, if not that third week, is what we saw at the Tour de Suisse, which was Onley the Lonely crossing the line by himself. Rob, you're shaking your head, quite rightly so. Apologies for that.
Are you getting a euro for every song title you can get in, or every song lyric you can get in?
Well, the England Euro 96 team on Picnic Post NL. They've also got one man we haven't mentioned. It was Tobias Lund Andersen, who could be dangerous in that first week. He's one of those kind of, you know, is he a sprinter? Is he more of a one day kind of classics rider? As well as Warren Barguil, who is more than likely to be a useful lieutenant, although I wouldn't be surprised to see him kind of have given permission one or two breakouts of his own if the mood takes. Which leads me, Lionel, to our other French assets scattered across various teams.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier 40 years of hurt. It's 40 years since the French last won the Tour de France. That was Bernard Hinault, of course, in 1985. François Thomazeau then started covering the Tour in 1986, and no Frenchman has won since then. I don't think there's any correlation between those two things. I don't think François had anything to do with the four decades long drought of French Tour de France winners. They're not going to win the Tour this year, are they? But there are the sort of green shoots of a couple of talented riders whose progress will be really interesting to monitor this year. Lenny Martinez of Bahrain Victorious, as we heard from Rod Ellingworth in the podcast a couple of weeks ago, they were hoping for a much better GC week at the Dauphiné, but he faltered, potentially because of the heat, they thought. And then he kind of came good on the last day and won that final stage. The Bahrain Victorious team really do think that Lenny Martinez could be a future Tour winner. I mean, he's a tiny little rider. He's not going to be great in a Tour which has got a lot of sort of flat time trialing. He would probably need a course with just lots of uphill finishes. He is a very good climber. This is, you know, very early in his development, but they're setting him out on a path to accrue the experience to one day contend for the GC. We'll have to see how he goes on. The other rider that really kind of stood out in the last couple of weeks, Romain Grégoire at the Tour de Suisse, had a very good first half of the race there. His teammate at Groupama, Guillaume Martin, Rob, as you said before we started recording this part, he's kind of up and down Grand Tour. It's almost become his kind of default. Gain 5 minutes one day, lose it the next, gain it back again, lose it, gain it back again, and then finish sort of somewhere between sort of 8th and 13th. Don't really expect to see anything too different from him. It might get him breaks in the mountains and have a shot at stage wins. The two old French guys, Warren Barguil, you mentioned, former King of the Mountains, Julien Alaphilippe, of course, worn the yellow jersey, won stages, and we've seen a little flicker of a renaissance from Julien Alaphilippe again in the Tour of Switzerland. There are stages in that first week that really suit him. And of course, now he's the out-and-out leader of one of the smaller teams, Tudor Pro Cycling. He's going to have a lot of opportunities at least. You know, he's going to be able to set his own agenda throughout the Tour. And then we've got the battle for Berry, the Yates brothers. There's also the Paris-Peintre brothers, Valentin on Soudal Quickstep and Aurélien on Decathlon. I wouldn't like to take a bet on who will finish highest on GC out of those two. But we'll see one or other of them in breaks, won't we, through a lot of the second half of the Tour, I would have thought. They're that kind of rider.
I would think so. The only thing I would say is that Valentin, depending on how Remco Evenepoel gets on, he will be probably pulled aside and said, no, you're with me, and hanging on with the likes of Van Wilder. And we'll see what kind of Catania and Schachmann turn up as well, because they'll be trying to provide as much beef and support as possible for Evenepoel.
Of course, because Soudal Quickstep lost Mikel Landa on the opening day of the Giro d'Italia. And I spoke to Alessandro Tenier, part of the management team at the Soudal Quickstep team. I saw him in the airport on my way home from the Giro, and he was saying basically at that point the tour would probably not be possible for Landa, but you never know with kind of the superhuman recovery of these pro athletes. But he's not made it, and that is a big loss for Remco Evenepoel to lose Mikel Landa for his support in the mountains.
Michael Storer is one other rider for Tudor that we haven't mentioned, who has had...
Surprised me to see him on the start list, actually, after all the racing he's done.
After the Giro, after the Tour of the Alps, which he won, of course. So Tudor are going in with a sort of quietly strong... and very, very interesting team. Lionel...
It's a World Tour level team, isn't it? You look at the names down there.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, and 3 years ago, a very, very strong World Tour level team. But they've more than earned their place on the special invites list. So, pleasing that we got a Euro 96 reference in there earlier with the... I'm going to give us another one with the Coupe Omnisport still gleaming.
Wow.
No, too much. Shall we hear from Francois on the third week before we go any further?
Well, Francois, the final week kicks off with the Giant of Provence, Mont Ventoux, of course, the first appearance in the race since 2021. That year, they went over it two ways, but they finished down in Malocène. The finish in 2016 was moved down the mountain to Chalet Renard because there were high winds at the top and it wasn't going to be safe. So they moved the finish down to kind of where the tree line ends in Chalet Renard, and the huge crowds all came down the mountain to watch the tour, and it was really overcrowded, wasn't it? And it meant that there was this incident with Chris Froome. He crashed, he lost his bike, he was running for a while, then he rode a bike that was much too small. And the thing that everybody kind of forgets or overlooks is that it was Thomas de Gendt who actually won the stage that day. The one to Valence on stage 17, the classic transitional day, will certainly be for the sprinters, before Tadej Pogacar revisits the scene of his spectacular crack in 2023, the Col de la Loze. Now, it's a different side to 2020 and 2023, not quite as hard, but still it's the Henri Desgranges prize for being the highest point in the Tour de France. They go over the Glandon and the Madeleine before it, so that makes it hard enough. A return to La Plagne, which to, again, somebody of my generation is synonymous with the 1987 Tour de France, where Laurent Fignon won the stage and Stephen Roach really saved his Tour de France. He'd been dropped by Pedro Delgado, who was riding away to win the Tour, but Roach dug deep in the final kilometres, so deep that he needed oxygen after the finish line, but he did limit his losses and ended up winning the Tour. We have been back there since. Michael Bogaert of the Netherlands won there in 2020. Pontarlier, stage 20, the penultimate one of the race. Now, this is famous to me because it's the biggest breakaway I can ever remember. The 2001 Tour de France, when 14 riders got 36 minutes lead. We'll probably talk about this a bit more during the tour. But the highlights of that day were that Eric Decker won the stage, Stuart O'Grady took the yellow jersey, and there was a huge time gap to Lance Armstrong and all the other favourites. Francois Simon, who was in the break, took over the yellow jersey a few days later and still had 20 minutes lead over Lance Armstrong at Alpe d'Huez before finally cracking in the Pyrenees. And then the final day of the tour, to mark the 50th anniversary of the Champs-Élysées, they're sort of downgrading the significance of the Champs-Élysées a bit. They're still doing the laps of the famous boulevard, but it's a very different finish, three times over the Montmartre climb. And the final climb comes just 6 kilometres from the finish. This, of course, was the key feature of the Olympic Games road race in Paris last year. And it's going to lead to a very different and potentially exciting conclusion to the tour, Francois.
Yeah, there's been quite a controversy. You know, a few riders saying, oh, why do you do that? It's going to be a mess. This is one thing, you know, how much I respect the riders. But every time there's a novelty, you know, they always criticize that the cycling for being too traditional, being this and that. But every time there's a novelty in the tour, oh my God, there are cobbles. Oh my God, we're going up Montmartre. Well, guys, you know that's up to you to make the most of it. And you know, it was funny to see Remco Evenepoel criticize the decision when he actually, you know, shattered the race at the Olympics on that climb to Montmartre. How can you not do that? My impression is that we come at the end of the 50 years of the Champs-Élysées a little bit, and that. Prudhomme and tour organizers wouldn't be too unhappy if Montmartre became a fixture of the last stage because of the crowds at the Olympics. It was fantastic, you know, and it's what the tour is about, you know, being close to the crowd, close to the public. You can't be more Parisian than Montmartre. I'm sorry for the Champs-Élysées, you know, but you could be anywhere. It could be on Pullman. No, but Montmartre is so iconic, and once again, so yeah, it adds a little bit of excitement. But I'm really glad they do that. And about the rest of the last week, for me, the main question is, as I put it before, it'll be hot. It'll be really hot all the way up the mountain. We know, remember La Plagne, you mentioned Fignon, 1987. They both collapsed at the finish, Fignon and Stephen Roach, who was, you know, I remember it very well. It was my second Tour de France. So it'll be exhausting again. You know, La Plagne is dreadful. It's everything I hate about the Alps. You know, I don't like the Alps much, but it's...
Why? Why not? Why don't you like La Plagne? Or what is it about La Plagne?
La Plagne is totally artificial. There was nothing there. It's a ski resort that was created out of nowhere. It only operates during the winter for the ski season. And we know that with, you know, temperature changes, that these resorts are probably doomed to... And will not exist in 20 or 30 years. So they have to reinvent themselves. Unfortunately, I'm sorry for people from La Plagne, but and the way La Plagne was conceived and built, you know, with the you'll see where it's a little bit the same with La Bresse. You know, it was all this kind of 1970s architecture. It's not made to last. It doesn't quite fit in with the landscape and the scenery. It's just a place that's been created out of nowhere for the winter sports industry. And you know, that's one of the reasons why I don't like it, but there you are.
The contrast, though, Mont Ventoux is stunning and beautiful and you know, can be very unpredictable because the weather there, even in a glorious fine summer, you can be down in Carpentras and it will be a glorious hot sunny day, and then you get up onto the mountain and the wind's blowing and it's cold somehow, or you know, it's a very strange weather system all of its own. And the Col de la Loze, I mean, that's the very opposite of La Plagne. I mean, that is beautiful. I mean, it's stunning, stunning all around there. So we get a little bit of everything in the Alps. Just on that finish in Paris, the Champs-Élysées, the 50th anniversary of the first finish on the Champs-Élysées, it obviously denies the sprinters an opportunity. You would think 6 kilometers from the finish there could be breakaways, there could be a GC racing, because there might be places on the podium still up for grabs if the time gaps are small. It really changes, I think, the complexion of the final week of the tour, because it incentivizes everybody to try and open up time gaps before getting to the last day and not leaving anything to chance going over that climb of Montmartre, because it is hard enough to split up the race for sure.
Yeah, it makes it a little bit more unpredictable. And finally, for the last week, I think that because of the heat, the Col de la Loze and everything we mentioned, it'll be a real test for Tadej Pogacar. We know how he's been dominating cycling for the past year and a half, or maybe two years. But once again, if he burns energy in the first week, and if the heat is what it's expected to be, and it'll be back on some terrain that we do, bad memories of Otaka, bad memories of La Loze, there are quite a few places in which Pogacar could stumble, you know, and it's obvious. And Vingegaard, you know, will have a much more cautious approach to all that. And No, it'll be more exciting than we think.
I mean, it's a month until the third week of the Tour de France, Francois. The weather forecast is the ultimate in speculation. The only thing you can take from this preview now is that the last week of the race will be rainy and cold. Francois, thank you. See you in Lille.
See you. Cheers, Lionel.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Well, chaps, 1975 was a massive year, a significant year in cycling history, not because that was the year I was born. Very early on in the Tour de France, the 1975 Tour de France, I was actually going to look up who won the stage the day I was born.
That's an old Nike advert from back in the day. With it, 66 was a great year for English football. Eric was born, Eric Cantona.
Well, the stage was won by Theo Smit, a Dutch rider who I don't know an awful lot about, but he won what looks like a sprint finish ahead of Rick van Linden and Eddie Merckx. Now, lots of anniversaries being celebrated by the Tour de France this year. 1975 was the last year that Eddie Merckx wore the yellow jersey, of course, and it's also significant, as we heard, the Champs-Élysées is hosting the finish of the Tour de France. It's the 50th anniversary of the first finish on the Champs-Élysées. That was in 1975. The stage was won by Walter Godefroot. We're going to explore the whole history of the Champs-Élysées and its relationship with the Tour de France when we get over there, Graham. Of course, last year, the race was notable because it didn't finish on the Champs-Élysées. It finished in Nice because the Olympic Games were being held in Paris, of course, very shortly after the finish of the Tour de France. And this new finish, the climb of Montmartre, they're going over it three times, and then there's a real sort of dive down into the Champs-Élysées. It's going to put a really different complexion on that final stage of the Tour, isn't it, Rob?
It certainly is. I mean, it's the traditional finale, but it's a completely different parcours. You've got Montmartre, and I think a few of us were talking just off mic, and when the news came out, it was during the Giro, wasn't it? I was with Sean, and we're both looking at each other. Surely they're not going to have that top of that climb in the last 10 kilometers. Well, they are. Just imagine if there's a few seconds in it. This is obviously, you can see where the organizers are going here. They'd quite like that moment, wouldn't they? They'd quite like the GC winner to be holding their arms, having just won it in Paris. I mean, that is a very distant dream, perhaps, and a lot of things have to fall into place. They need to get all their lottery numbers coming up for that to happen. But will the sprinters be happy? The breakaway artists might be buoyed. GC contenders set off in a state of panic just looking at it. Again, there's a lot of water to flow under that particular bridge before the stage itself, but it certainly makes you think, doesn't it? It's a 120-kilometre stage from Mont-la-Ville, just outside of Paris, into Paris Champs-Élysées with. And I think the first thing that they'll be hoping for, and the more realistic aim, gents, is to get those images of all the crowds on the side of the road as they climb up through Montmartre.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things about this that come to mind. I mean, the Champs-Élysées finish has been sort of the unofficial sprinters' world championships. You know, Mark Cavendish won four times on the Champs-Élysées, the record. You know, the stages won by non-sprinters are a relative rarity. There are some that leap out. I mean, Bernard Hinault won on the Champs-Élysées, for example. Eddie Seigneur did a jump in 94 to deny the pure sprinters. But generally speaking, we've seen a sprint on the Champs-Élysées. I think everything hinges on how the GC looks that morning. If it's close, if there's even gaps between second and third, or third and fourth, or even sixth or seventh, you know, that we could see some interesting racing. And then it becomes about, will they have the kind of processional rollout with the glasses of bubbly, you know, the traditional photographs of the jersey wearers riding at the front of the peloton. If any of those jerseys are up for grabs, you know, there might be a little bit of a switch to that convention. It's going to be an interesting race. as you say, Rob, the dream would be for the Tour winner to break away over the final time of the climb and finish solo on the Champs-Élysées, arms aloft in the yellow jersey. That would give all of the kind of the marketing people behind the Tour de France the perfect finish to the race. But I remember when Alexandra Vinokourov pinched fifth place from Levi Leipheimer in, when was that, 2004 or
2005?
2005, wasn't it? You know, just nicking a few seconds to jump from sixth to fifth. So it's not without precedent that the race can be altered on the final day. This kind of argument that it's processional and it's just a last kind of gallop to the line and everything must stay how it was on the Saturday night, I don't think that's really the case. We saw in last year's Tour, you know, the race could have been alive on the final day with the time trial. The fact that it wasn't, you know, was just because of the way the race panned out. I think it's interesting. And I also think it's interesting that a lot of the people who've said, oh, do away with the final laps around the Champs-Élysées, it's boring and it's not a real race. Well, now we might have a real race and we'll see, you know, who's still complaining. There's bound to be somebody still complaining.
Oh, there will be. You imagine the team that might be in, you know, hypothetically in the jersey with a small lead, depending on which team and which rider it is. There could be some, oh, well, shall we take the times here? Well, oh, it's dangerous. We'll neutralise. And again, it's difficult to argue with that because, you know, they're racing through pretty dangerous streets up there. But you can sort of see that situation arising. We will see. It's going to be dramatic, whatever happens, I think. Certainly, if it's not on the road, it'll be in the talking.
Could Montmartre also be decisive for the KOM? For the polka dots jersey on the first climb?
I mean, it could be if the points could are be. Very close. I mean, it won't be, there won't be a huge number of points available, but if it's, if it comes down to a handful of points, yeah, it could. But I think it's just nice that it's different. You know, this may well be the new normal for a few years. We don't know, but I think the fact that we'll have a different race to watch on the final day is something that we should celebrate rather than criticise. And I think, you know, if it is, you know, split by 40 seconds or say between Pogacar and Vingegaard, I mean, there's no doubting which side of that argument I would be on. Come on, guys, it's a race to the finish line in the Champs-Élysées.
Exactly.
And that's what you all signed up for at the beginning of July. So the race isn't over until they all cross the finish line on the Champs-Élysées. That's always been the case. So we shall see. Let's hope that it is beautifully poised going into that final day.
Well, the last time they switched it up, the organisers switched it up, was, I think I'm right in saying 1989, where we saw the closest finish in Tour history, 8 seconds between Le Mans and Fignon.
Absolutely. The final day time trial, which they were hoping to replicate the drama of in last year's finish in Nice. Of course, it didn't work out that way. I think the Tour has always evolved. It's always changed. There's always an innovation that is criticised. We have it every time the cobbles are in the race or the gravel when that was in the race. I think it's, you know, the course is known to everybody. They've all got the same road book. They all know what the rules are, and bring it on Saturday. I just want to mention another couple of significant 50th anniversaries that the Tour will be marking. It's the 50th anniversary of the polka dot jersey. We'll be exploring this again in some of our Tour coverage. I wonder if either of you can name the first wearer of the polka dot jersey awarded to the leader in the King of the Mountains competition.
Not me.
It was Rob. Give you a second. No, it was Joep Zoetemelk. But the jersey was worn for the bulk of that Tour by Lucien Van Impe, a Belgian rider who was the King of the Mountains that year. The best climber classification had existed for a few decades before that, but this very distinctive polka dot jersey design was introduced in 1975, and we'll explore the reasons for that design and the influence behind it when we get underway. It's also the 50th anniversary of the white jersey for the best young rider. Now, this competition carried on through the sort of 90s and into the early 2000s, but without the white jersey. They brought the white jersey back at some point in the early 2000s, I think it was. Anyway, the 50th anniversary. Can you name the first wearer and winner of the white jersey in the Tour de France for best young rider?
Rob's shaking his head. I'm going to verbalise shaking my head.
0 for 2 here. It was Francesco Moser, riding his one and only Tour de France, astonishingly. He was the best young rider in 1975. I was not the best young rider in 1975 because I was only a matter of days old. But yeah, 1975, several significant Tour de France anniversaries to mark in this year's race. And I'm sure the Tour will have something planned to celebrate each of those few things there.
Any other business, gents, is what I want to come on to. But before I do, I just want to ask you both, what are you most looking forward to?
I think we just mentioned it, Paris. Just for several different reasons, because it is new, because it could be exciting. And I'll be back on the finish line for that stage as well. I'll be looking forward to that.
What about you, Graham, before I go?
Oh, it's got to be Mont Ventoux, isn't it? It's the mountain stage for me.
Yeah, looking forward to that one. Been a few years since we've been there. Certainly went over it, didn't we? Over it twice from two different directions.
Take your running shoes, Van boys.
Art, yeah.
Yeah, so look, I'm looking forward to that as well. Always a special place to go. For me, it is Cassoulet, the 2 days of Cassoulet, Toulouse and Carcassonne. Very much looking forward to
it. That sounds like a February stage race.
Introducing you, Graham.
The 2 days of Cassoulet.
Yeah, we'll get your thoughts on Cassoulet, the finest meal on the tour route. And I'm also looking forward to, I'm hoping that we're going to be able to make a visit to the Bio Tapestry at the start of stage six. I missed my school trip there when I was at school. So I'm looking forward to seeing what that's all about. Big tapestry, apparently. So shall we, before we wrap up, hear from someone who until early May was a big part of the Tour de France entourage, a sports director for the Jayco Alula team, previously had several different names, the Green Edge organization, of course. This is Matt White, and this is Whitey's Whiteboard, a little look at the tactics that go into selecting a Tour de France team and then choosing strategy on the road. How would team management typically pick the Tour de France team? How many riders are generally kind of known at, say, winter training camp or at the start of the season? And then how many slots are left open, you know, for the last month or two before the tour?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And I think it does vary from team to team. I think there's some teams, for example, Visma, who put out their Tour de France team pretty much in the winter. Lock it in, really. And there's other teams that would definitely have obviously the tour is a very important part of the season, but it's not the whole season. So obviously when in the planning phases in the pre-season, there will be groups of riders knowing which grand tour they are preparing for. And then I think a lot of those times, especially the Vuelta, I'd stay a little bit more open because of things that can happen in the Giro or the Tour, or you leave a little bit of room for maybe a young and up-and-coming rider who develops faster than you actually plan. But I would think most teams would go into the winter with a group of riders knowing that they are on the schedule for the Tour. Now, that could be a long list or a not-so-long list. You have to have more than eight guys preparing for the Tour de France. So I know that we've been caught out once or twice when we've had some last-minute issues with a couple of riders and having to scramble for guys getting ready for the Tour de France. So, you know, it also depends on the focus as well. You know, if you're putting a really, really big focus on into the Giro, trying to win the Giro, you probably have as good a team at the Giro than you do at the Tour de France. So a lot of those guys, then you can't, or it's not optimal to then use those guys 4 weeks later in the Tour de France. So like I said, most teams would have a plan of who they're preparing for the Tour de France and what their goals are, but not too many teams go in with 100% locked and loaded roster a long way out.
Obviously, it depends team to team, but how much does the route influence team selection? I mean, if you haven't got a rider who could finish in the top five on GC and your target is going to be stage wins, how much are you looking at the actual route and working out which kind of riders to take?
It depends on how much of a priority is your sprinter and then what type of other riders you have available in the roster. For example, this year's Tour de France route is not a lot of opportunities for the pure sprinter. I would think five only. There's a lot more opportunities for the roulette type hybrid sprinter who can get through 2,500 to 3,000 meters of climbing or an uphill finish. So is that your priority? If that's your priority, then you've got to back that sprinter. But then if you haven't got someone who can win on those flat stages, maybe you're taking more punchers. The beauty of the tour is that you will have the route in October, which is well before pre-season. You would have a group preparing And then if someone shows some really good form who can win in breakaways, or your sprinter's not firing as you would like them to be, or your GC rider is doing whatever he's doing, then you just tinker with those last spots depending on form and what you see.
And tactically, how do you kind of set out the plan for the tour? You go in with an overall goal and then break it down sort of week by week, day by day?
Yeah, look, again, I've only been in a couple of teams in the World Tour, but how I would really like to break it down always would be, okay, identify where your strengths are, where your weaknesses are, and look at stages that you think are the ones sort of in between. Because everyone knows a sprint stage is a sprint stage. Okay, the nitty-gritty you can work out on different apps. You can use Avant Course. And at the end of the day, it's not really worth looking at those stages, the sprint stages, until they're barricaded, really, because the devil is in the details in the sprint stages. The mountains, the high mountain stages, again, a lot of GC guys aren't really too fussed about seeing the big stages because, one, you know, for them, it's a 30-minute, 40-minute effort. They know the gradients. There's nothing special. I think where the real value in looking at courses with the sports directors, and maybe not so much the athletes, because they are on a busy schedule with camps and races, is those in-between stages. We would put a lot of effort into the Giro, into those stages in the middle of Italy, in the south of Italy, the ones that aren't the easiest to get to, because they're those stages. You're not going to win or lose a Giro in those stages, but you could definitely save a lot of energy. And I suppose that would be the equivalent of the massive central. And then there's other stages during the Tour de France where if it's potentially a windy stage, you might know what the stage is, but it's, you know, if you've got the luxury of having a third or a fourth director or someone who you trust with good info, you'll put someone 30 minutes to an hour in front of the tour. And giving you live weather updates
on a kind of day-to-day basis in the tour. How does a management group kind of come up with the plan for the following day? And tactically, how involved are the riders in sort of setting that plan and having some input into what the plan for a day is going to be?
Yeah, I think that's quite individual between teams. I think there's some teams where it's really set in concrete. They have a pretty locked-in plan. They have to adapt to a certain extent. But I think that there is still a bit of an I say you do mentality in some teams, for sure. Then there's other teams that are pretty loose and they do rely on a lot of rider feedback. I think for myself, the best way is a mix of the two. I think you go into the Tour de France with the ideal plan of a stage by stage, but that changes. It changes on what you can achieve. That changes on what you have achieved. It changes who's got the yellow jersey. Is there a strong leader in the elite at the moment, or is there someone that's looking to get rid of the jersey within a couple of days? That totally changes the tactics of the day. So you can't be that rigid this is our plan before the tour. This we're going to stick to it, because you've got to be able to adapt to the day and who's, you know, there's races within races. You know, you go into the Tour de France with eight healthy riders. Now, that very rarely do you get through the Tour de France with eight healthy riders. You know, whether it's illnesses, whether it's crashes, you've got to be able to adapt and use the resources that you have at your disposal daily.
In terms of giving riders information, is there a kind of limit on how much you can practically give them? And is there such a thing as kind of information overload that at a certain point they almost kind of stop taking it on board?
100%. And I think I learned that quite early on in my career as a sports director, that especially at the tour with so much going on, you've actually got to really pick and choose when you talk on the radio. Because one, at times, it's so stressful for the guys that it's actually hard for them to concentrate, because now they're wall to wall with other riders. They've got screaming fans either side. You've got to think on the radio, where are the riders now? Because yes, if your car won on a flat stage, okay, you're probably 500 meters behind them. If your car 10 on a mountain stage, you could be 3K behind them. They could be going down a descent while you're still going 1K from the top. So you've got to think, well, actually, Do the boys want to hear what I'm saying now on a technical descent at 75k an hour? Probably not. The meeting prior, what you, it should be about is painting a picture of what's coming up. And the rider should leave the meeting with that picture clear in their head and the plan clear what you want to achieve. Sometimes they have to make some calls that adapt quicker than you. And sometimes you've got to tweak those plans. But, you know, talking for 4 hours on a radio, it's just that now all you're doing is, I don't know, justifying your own job, because it is not getting absorbed. It is not getting absorbed. So, and look, I've been on teams where the radio has been very, very useful and teams do use it very well. And other teams where, you know, they might as well have put a parrot in there.
Explain how the car order is decided.
Yeah, so the car order is designed. The first day, it will be picked out of a hat. And then from then on in, it's the highest rider you have on general classification. And it does matter, one, for the radios, and two, for especially in the first week, if you have issues. You know, if you are, again, if you're car 23 and something happens to one of your riders, you are not getting there in a hurry, especially when the race is broken up and especially when there's big crowds, because you physically just can't pass that fast.
And lastly, just on like your, when you're working as a sports director, how much is it important to kind of gather as much information about what's going on in the race as possible? You know, bits of gossip about who might be feeling a bit sick. You know, if a team sprinter's sick, that might change whether they're going to chase the break, for example. You know, how much you're picking up information and just looking at the results sheet, but also trying to see little signs beyond the results, see what's going on in the race to kind of formulate your impression of what might happen on a given day.
Yeah, funny you say that. We actually assigned one person just to be on social media duties. Because at the end of the day, not all bike riders are that sharp. And you can find some pretty good information just because someone's put a microphone in front of their face and they blurted it out. Now there's some stages where you think, oh, I wonder how keen this team is on today. And then you look on social media and there's the leader of that team saying, no, today's a stage we are definitely targeting. So when you hear that, it's like, well, thank you. Thank you. We know, as long as they're not in the breakaway, that they will be chasing. You know, it's as simple as that.
I mean, this makes me feel skeptical about what you tell us in the mornings, Matt. You know, you could be giving us a whole load of misdirection.
Well, I said not all bike riders are sharp. Some are sharper than others.
And very lastly, like once a stage is over, say it's gone particularly well or particularly badly, how do you debrief? Do you pick and choose how and when to debrief? And then when does attention turn to the next day?
Yeah, look, I do know, because I whenever new guys come to a team that I've been in, I always grill them about, okay, how did you do this on this team? And you would be surprised by the level of incompetence on some teams still. Some teams just don't even talk about the day still. Some teams do a pretty structured debrief and some teams do a pretty loose debrief. But in the teams that I've always been in, we try to do it in the bus and the last 15 to 20 minutes of the journey, so that when the riders can get to the finish, that's when the day is done. That's when the focus then turns on to the next day. But I know there's many World Tour teams that do not even discuss what happened that day. At the end of the day, it's the culture that you have in the team as well, because sometimes they are not comfortable discussions. But at the end of the day, the debrief process should be about learning at how we do things better, acknowledging what you do right and learning about how to do things better. And you cannot do that unless you face some things head on. My way has always been, if I've got something to say, I'll say it in front of the whole group. And I don't like bothering the riders in their own rooms. I think when you get to the hotel, that's your time. That's your recovery time. That's the time to talk to your wife or your girlfriend or talk to your family. And just to sort of decompress after what has been a very stressful stage. So I like to do it all together, last 15 to 20 minutes of the journey. And if you've got to pull the Band-Aid off, you'd pull it off then and there and then move on to the next day.
fascinating to hear Matt White's thoughts. Maybe Whitey's whiteboard will become a permanent fixture, and maybe it'll be a white jersey competition, a way to keep tabs of that particular competition. Gents, we should wrap it up on our way to packing our bags to get out to Lille for you and I, Lionel. Rob, we're looking forward to seeing you in Paris. Great to catch up, mate.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it will fly by. I'm really looking forward to the start now.
Won't it just? And Lionel, presumably you've barely done your laundry from Glastonbury, or maybe you're just taking a stinking bag of clothes to Lille with you.
It's all going through the washing machine now, and I will be ready for the Grand Depart on Saturday. We're leaving for Lille on Friday. Hopefully we'll see a few people at Van Riesel House in Lille on Saturday. We'll drop in there while the stage is going on, I think, on Saturday. Just a couple of things I wanted to mention. Over the course of this week, we've been releasing a few episodes from our vast back catalogue of Kilometre Zero, just celebrating some different diverse aspects of our Tour de France coverage over the years. I put my episode made about my visit to Mont Ventoux from 2016 on the regular feed on Tuesday. You can listen to all of those episodes for a limited time only this week. Got another couple of things coming as we build up to the Grand Depart. There's also a new Friends of the Podcast episode featuring Lisa Brambaini, woman rider who rode the first Giro d'Italia for women back in 1988 and finished ninth overall. She's been interviewed by our producer, Tom Wally. It's a cracking interview. Gets a real insight into what women's racing was like back in the 80s, what the first Giro was like. There's an extraordinary anecdote about recovery techniques involving taking a bath in jelly, if you can believe that. And of course, Lisa Brambaini's reflections on how women's cycling has evolved since, because her daughter, Abby May Parkinson, later rode the Giro d'Italia Femminile as well. So that is available for Friends of the Podcast. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And it wouldn't be the Tour de France without the collection of wine from Divine Cellars. Greg Andrews and co. have curated a box to celebrate the Tour de France route. I'm still waiting to see details of that, but that should be dropping in my inbox very shortly. I'll mention that in the 1101 Cappuccino, and you'll be able to buy your case of wine and toast the Tour de France and the Cycling Podcast as it makes its way around France over the next 3 weeks. But I guess all that's left to say now, Graham, is see you at the Eurostar check-in on Friday morning.
Yes, you'll have to let me know what time.
Yeah, don't miss it.
Whenever it is.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.